shrieked at Logan. Do something! Logan went spastic, arms flailing, feet not knowing which way to move. He spotted Tiki in the kitchen and lunged for him, lifting him off the counter, wrapping him in his arms. Oren stood and pointed his gun at Logan. I knocked into Oren again, jostling the gun, and Oren drilled two rounds into Tiki. Logan let out a roar and charged Oren, bashing him in the face, using Tiki like a battering ram. Blood gushed from Oren's nose, and Logan immediately rammed Oren again, catching him square in the chest. I heard something go plink onto my tile floor. I looked down and saw that it was a pin to one of the grenades. Time stood still for a moment while we all stared at the pin. Oren grabbed at the live grenade still taped to his gun belt, and I kicked him hard in his prosthetic. The prosthetic flew off, and Oren lost his balance, wheeling around on one leg. Logan and I dove into the kitchen, and Oren fell face down and blew up in the foyer. I was stunned, sitting on the kitchen floor with my ears ringing. Logan was next to me, hugging Tiki.
He shouldn't have shot Tiki, Logan said. Hawaiian gods get even. Did you see what Tiki did to his foot? It flew right off his leg when you kicked it.
It was a prosthetic, I said to Logan.
I guess that would make it easier, Logan said.
I have a metal fire door with four deadbolts, but Oren had only thrown one of the locks when he closed the door. I heard someone put his foot to the door from the other side, and on the second attempt, the door crashed open against the wall. It was Hal. He took a couple steps in, gun drawn, avoiding what was left of Oren, and looked in the kitchen at me. I'm okay, I said. I thought there were sounds of elephants running in the hall, dimly heard over the ringing in my ears. It was Ranger and two more Rangeman guys. Not as big as elephants, but the two men with Ranger could easily have made the NFL playing defense. Ranger moved around Oren, stepped into the kitchen, and lifted me to my feet. He took a knife off his gun belt and cut my tape away.
I was on Hamilton when the alarm went off, Ranger said. I listened to you all the way and got here just as the explosion occurred. Hal was already at your door by then.
I looked down at the plus sign on the watch face. Hard to read, because I was shaking. I wasn't fast enough to hit the button when he first appeared, I said, and then my wrists were taped. He must have accidentally pushed the button when he grabbed me. People were accumulating in the hall. Ranger told one of the men to close the door and stand guard outside. Some of Oren was face down on the tile. Some of him was on my foyer wall. What was on the floor was charred and smoking. Only the prosthetic foot was still intact, halfway across the room.
What happened here? Ranger asked me.
He had what I thought might be explosives and a couple grenades taped to the ammo belts across his chest. There was a scuffle, and one of the grenades lost a pin. Logan and I dove for the kitchen, and Oren exploded. Ranger squatted beside the body.
The most common grenade sends fragments over a wide radius. Oren was a munitions genius, and I'm guessing this was some sort of designer incendiary device. We need to clear this area and bring in a bomb expert to make sure there aren't any more live explosives on him.
Is he dead? Logan asked.
This was a no-brainer question, considering what was left of Oren.
He's been dead for years, Ranger said.
Chapter 24. Logan carried Tiki into the hall. I grabbed my messenger bag, and Ranger carried Rex's hamster tank. By the time we reached the parking lot, emergency vehicles were rumbling in. A fire truck, an EMT truck, two police cars, Morelli in the Buick. Morelli parked and jogged over to us. He stood hands on hips, his expression grim.
Are you okay?
He asked me. Except for my ponytail, I said, and some minor burns on my neck. He looked up at my apartment windows.
What's going on?
The rocket guy blew himself up, I said. He needs to be checked out to make sure he's not still booby-trapped.
Are you on the job?
Ranger asked Morelli.
No, Morelli said. I'm off today. Gene Matson was working dispatch and called me when Rangeman asked for police assistance.
I'm going to see this through, Ranger said. It's not necessary for anyone else to stay. I'm sure Stephanie will have to give a statement, but she can do that downtown some other time. I have the explosion and events immediately preceding it recorded.
Morelli took Rex from Ranger.
Where do you want to go first, my house or a hair salon?
I gave up a sigh. Your house, I said. I glanced at Logan and thought he looked lost, cradling Tiki, unsure of his place. Can we take Logan with us?
Sure,
Morelli said, slinging an arm around me.
Let's go home.
We piled into the Buick and chugged out of the lot. Minutes later, we were in Morelli's nice, normal neighborhood, and the explosion seemed far away.
I thought you were taking me to jail,
Logan said when we parked. It's not at the top of my list, I told him. I want to change out of this wet shirt, zone out on Morelli's couch, and let it sink in that the nightmare is over. I went upstairs, swapped my shirt for one of Morelli's t-shirts, trudged into the bathroom, and looked at my hair. Any other time I would have burst into tears, but right now, I was happy just to be alive. It's hair, I told myself. It'll grow. I crawled into Morelli's bed and woke up hours later in a panic. The wedding! I'd forgotten all about the wedding! I ran downstairs and found Morelli, Logan, Tiki, and Bob on the couch watching television. Did Ranger call? Did I miss anything? I asked.
We got the bullets out of Tiki, filled him in with wood putty, and colored it with a brown magic marker, Logan said. He's feeling a lot better.
Morelli had his hand in a bag of chips.
Ranger called and I told him you were sleeping. He's coming by at 2 o'clock with the dress. Since the original maid of honor didn't think she could lose 30 pounds in time to fit the altered dress, she relinquished the gig to you. And apparently Amanda really wanted you to still be in the wedding. Ranger said if you needed anything from your apartment, you should call him.
It's almost 2 now, I said. Why didn't you wake me?
I went up to look in on you and you were out like a light. I thought you needed the sleep.
I felt around the back of my head for the burned-off ponytail. I need to do something with my hair.
Cupcake, that's a lost cause. I can cut the singed ends off if you want.
The doorbell rang, and Ranger walked in, carrying the plastic bag dress. He was in his tux, with a 5 o'clock shadow and dark circles under his eyes.
You look like you could use a beer,
Morelli said, getting to his feet.
It's been a long day, Ranger said, handing the dress over to me.
I carried the dress upstairs, took a fast shower, and pulled what was left of my hair into a ponytail again. I searched in Morelli's medicine chest for aloe ointment and smeared some on my blistered neck. I slipped the acres of pink taffeta over my head and struggled to get it zipped. What had originally been a dress from the Little House on the Prairie collection was now straight out of the Little Whorehouse on the Prairie collection. It was so tight and cut so low in the bodice that my boobs were all popped out. If the material hadn't snagged on my nipples, they'd have been popped out too. I smashed myself in as best I could and went downstairs. I marched into the living room in my dress and sneakers. Do not say one word, I said. I will personally make a eunuch out of anyone who makes a crack about this dress or my hair.
I like it,
Morelli said. You're skating on thin ice, mister, I told him. Ranger set his empty beer bottle on the coffee table and stood.
Let's get this done.
I followed him out and stood looking at the 911 turbo. I'm not going to fit, I said. How am I going to get all of this dress into this little car?
Get in, and I'll do the rest, Ranger said.
I swiveled around, dropped into the seat, and Ranger beat the dress into submission and stuffed it in. He was laughing when he got behind the wheel. Now what? I asked.
You're wearing sneakers. I hope the bridal shop lady never finds out.
You didn't notice in the house?
My eyes never got lower than your nipples. If it wasn't for the fact that Morelli would shoot me, I would have taken you on his front lawn.
Perfect, I thought. I have half my hair burned off, I'm wearing the dress from hell, and all I have to do is show a little nipple and I'm a sex goddess. Something to remember. Ranger rolled out of the lot and headed for Hamilton Avenue.
Your apartment is relatively clean and your door is fixed. I have another cleaning crew coming in the morning. I wouldn't advise going back there tonight. It'll be fine after tomorrow.
Oren?
Defused and taken away.
Do you want to talk about it?
No, Ranger said. I want to let it rest.
When you're ready to talk about it, I'll tell you what he told me before he set my hair on fire. He was very, very sick.
I know he was sick, and maybe someday I'll want to know his reasoning and his inner demons, but right now, I'm moving on.
He parked in the church lot, and we walked to the side door. We were originally supposed to be with Kinsey and Amanda prior to the wedding, but circumstances had, of course, changed that. The other ushers were already collected in the vestibule. Guests were beginning to arrive. A room had been reserved for the bride and her bridesmaids. Ranger dropped me there and went to wait for Kinsey. Everyone was there but Amanda. She was coming with her parents. None of the other women were popping out of their dresses, and no one else had hair styled by a Bic lighter. They were relatives of the bride, college roommates, and best friends. They were all good people, including me in their pre-wedding excitement. No one mentioned my hair, but it was the elephant in the room. "It was set on fire," I finally said. "I had an episode with a crazy person, and he set my hair on fire." Everyone went bug-eyed. "What happened to the crazy person?" one of the women asked. "He blew himself up." "Get out! You mean like guts all over the place?" "Not all over the place," I said. "He was pretty well contained, all things considered." Ranger called on my phone and asked me to come into the hall. I went out and found him smiling.
"They eloped," he said.
"Seriously?"
"Kinsey just called. They're on a plane for Paris."
"Gee," I said. "I'm all dressed up. I was looking forward to walking down the aisle in my sneakers."
"You can wear your sneakers to the reception. They're going ahead with it."
"I'll pass on the reception." Ranger kissed me on the top of the head.
"Good choice."
Morelli, Logan, Tiki, and Bob were still in front of the television when I returned. Logan and Bob were asleep. Tiki was ever vigilant. Morelli looked bored.
"Short wedding," Morelli said.
"They eloped at the last minute." Morelli looked at Logan.
"What am I supposed to do with him? Are we adopting him?"
"No. Give me a minute to get out of this monstrosity, and I'll take him off your hands." I ran upstairs, shucked the dress, and got back into my jeans and Morelli's t-shirt. I went into Morelli's upstairs office and sat at his desk. I pulled up an online travel site on his computer, searched for tickets to Hawaii, and booked Logan and Tiki on a red-eye leaving from Newark. I returned to the living room and grabbed my messenger bag. "I need the keys to the Buick," I said to Morelli. "I'm taking Logan for a ride."
"You're not going to drop him off in a field like a stray cat, are you?"
"No, and I wouldn't do that to a stray cat either." I woke Logan, gave him a granola bar, and told him we were heading out.
"Are we going to jail?"
he asked. "No," I told him. "I'm going to get you and Tiki back to Hawaii."
"I haven't got the moolah,"
Logan said.
"I only saved up enough for half a ticket."
"My treat," I said.
"This could be construed as helping a fugitive to flee," Morelli said.
I rolled my eyes at Morelli. "He bashed in a police car. That's everyone's fantasy." Morelli turned back to the television.
"I didn't hear anything. This conversation never took place. Do you want me to ride along with you?"
"Not necessary," I said. "But thanks." I got Logan and Tiki buckled into the Buick, and I made my way to the highway. Route 1 wasn't bad at this time of the evening on a Saturday, and once I got on the turnpike, I flew. I pulled into short-term parking and walked Logan to the terminal. I waited while he and Tiki sailed through check-in with their e-tickets for two seats and went through security without a hitch. I walked back to the Buick, feeling good. It had been a really weird day, but it was ending happy. I got a mental message from Tiki a few minutes before 7 that they were about to take off, and he wanted to thank me. Minutes later, I got a text message from Morelli telling me to pick up a pizza on my way home. Chapter 25. Morelli and I were halfway through the large pizza, extra cheese, extra pepperoni, when Grandma called me. "I cracked the case," she said. "I got it all figured out. Millie Dabrowski and I went to the diner on Livingston for dinner tonight because Millie was hankering for the rice pudding. That's a diner the old coots went to when it turned out they couldn't rough up Jeffrey Cubbin. Well, we're walking in, and I notice they got business hours on the door, and it says they close at 1 o'clock. That means the nurse fibbed about seeing Cubbin in his bed at 2 o'clock. Cubbin went missing a lot earlier." I was gobstruck. It was suddenly so clear why we didn't see Cubbin leave. We were watching the wrong segment of video. "You're a genius," I said to Grandma. "Yep. I'm a regular Sherlock." I hung up with Grandma and told Morelli about the diner hours. We watched the wrong part of the video, I said. We need to go back and watch from the beginning of the shift. I called Briggs and told him we'd meet him in his office in a half hour and that we wanted to see earlier video. He said he'd have everything ready to roll by the time we got there. Morelli gave the last piece of pizza to Bob, I gave a small chunk to Rex, and we took off for the hospital.
I was going to ask for 24 hours of video to begin with, Morelli said, but I have a monster caseload, and after reviewing the nurse's statements, I was hoping it wasn't necessary.
My excuse wasn't that legitimate. I hadn't wanted to spend that much time with Randy Briggs. We parked and walked through the lobby together. Visiting hours were coming to a close, and Morelli badged his way past the reception desk. I'm used to working with Ranger, but not so much with Morelli. I always feel like an illegitimate stepchild when I work with Morelli. He's a Trenton cop, and I'm someone with a badge I bought on the internet. Briggs was waiting in his office. Mickey Ziegler was patrolling the floors.
"Holy crap," Briggs said when he saw me. "What happened to your hair? It looks like it got too close to a barbecue."
"Pretty close to the truth," I said. "Are you set to go?"
"Yeah, I have all the cameras on the screen and backed up to 11 o'clock.
Morelli and I pulled chairs around to face the monitor, and Briggs got the video rolling at fast forward. The time ticked off on the bottom of the picture. At 11:45, the Yeti stepped out of the service elevator, pushing a large laundry hamper.
"Stop," I said. "It's the Yeti."
The picture was grainy and the light was low, but I was sure it was him. He was dressed in scrubs, like an orderly. He kept his head down and quickly moved down the hall and off camera.
"Are you sure?" Briggs asked. "How could it be the Yeti?"
"Pull just that camera up," I said. "I want to see it again." Briggs went back to 11:45. The elevator doors opened and the Yeti came on screen. We watched him disappear down the hall and we let the video keep running. At 11:53, the Yeti appeared again, pushing the laundry hamper. It was clear from the way he was pushing that the hamper was heavier than before. He rolled the hamper back to the service elevator and disappeared into it.
"That's how Cubbin got off the floor," I said, "in the laundry hamper."
"There's laundry pickups like that all day long," Briggs said. "Nobody would even notice this guy."
Morelli leaned forward.
"Run the camera on the loading dock."
"Give me a minute to find it," Briggs said.
He scrolled through a series of cameras. He locked onto the loading dock and reset the time for 11:55. A white panel van was already backed up to the platform. At 11:59, the Yeti rolled the laundry hamper into the van doors closed, and the van drove away.
"Damn," Briggs said, "that's how they did it."
We looked at the video several more times. There was no writing on the side of the van, and the license was obscured. The driver wasn't visible.
"Dollars to donuts, that van went to the clinic," Briggs said.
I looked over at Morelli. "Do you want to take another look?"
"At the clinic?"
"Yep."
"Now?"
"Yep." He slouched back in his chair and looked at me.
"I shouldn't do this. This could get me in a lot of trouble."
"If you get kicked off the force, you can always get a job here," I said. "Briggs would hire you."
"Not funny," Morelli said.
I stood and returned my chair to the front of Briggs's desk. "I'm going to the clinic with or without you, and I'm going to find out what happens to these guys after they leave the hospital."
"I'm with you," Briggs said. "Count me in."
Morelli scraped his chair back.
"Me too."
I went in the Buick with Morelli, and Briggs followed in his car. We turned onto Route 1, drove a couple miles, and turned off into the light industrial complex. We drove to the end of the cul-de-sac and idled in front of the clinic. Lights shone on the second floor. "I'm pretty sure that's the area they're using for a surgical suite," I said to Morelli. "The day room and the lab are in the back of the building. The operating room and patient rooms are in the front. When I was here last time, I parked in the lot next to the clinic." Morelli drove to the Myron Cryo lot and cut the engine.
"Do you have a plan?" he asked.
"No. Do you?"
"Nope. I assumed we'd play it by ear. If we attempt entry into the clinic and an alarm goes off and the police show up, I'm running into the woods and hanging you out to dry."
"Been there? Done that," I said.
"Thought I should get it out in the open," Morelli said.
"No problem." Fact is, if the police showed up, I'd be in the woods before Morelli. We got out of our cars, stumbled through the patch of woods, and stood looking at the back of the clinic.
How do we get in? Morelli asked.
Briggs lets us in.
Then what?
I didn't know. Then what?
Suppose we send Briggs in and he snoops around and comes back with a report, Morelli said.
I guess I could do that, Briggs said.
Shouldn't he have a wire or something? I said. What if he gets caught? Morelli looked at me like I was from Mars.
It's my day off, he said. I don't have any wires in my back pocket.
Hey, I said, I'm just saying.
Do you have a gun? Morelli asked Briggs.
Yeah, I have a gun, Briggs said.
Well, if you get caught, you can shoot someone, Morelli said. If we hear shooting, we'll call the police.
Don't pay attention to him, I said to Briggs. Just be careful and you'll be fine. I went to the drop box and opened it. Okay, I said to Morelli. Pick him up and stuff him in. Morelli looked at the drop box and looked at Briggs.
You're not going to tell anyone I did this, right? Blood oath, sworn to secrecy.
Just stuff him in, I said. Morelli picked Briggs up and slid him into the drop box. I closed the box, there was some banging, and then there was quiet. I opened the box and looked in. Empty. He's inside, I said to Morelli.
This is freaky, Morelli said. What do we do now?
We wait. Morelli wrapped an arm around me.
Want to make out?
No. Suppose something goes wrong and the Yeti comes out after us. If we're making out, you might not be able to run.
Why not?
You know.
I can run like that, Morelli said. I can jump out of second-story windows like that. I had a lot of experience when I was in high school.
We waited for 5 minutes, but didn't see any sign of Briggs. 10 minutes. No Briggs. I'm worried, I said to Morelli.
Do you want me to try to stuff you into the drop box?
Try the door. Maybe he opened it before he wandered away. Morelli tried the door, and it opened.
This is illegal entry, Morelli said.
Only for you, I told him. I have rights. I stepped inside the dimly lit garage and let my eyes adjust. There were 4 cars parked. White panel van, black Escalade, silver Lexus, red Jaguar. Something's going down, I said to Morelli. All the players are here. Maybe we should call the police.
I'm the police.
I was thinking it might be better to have guys in uniform.
What are you going to say to guys in uniform? Are you going to tell them I shoved Briggs into the drop box and he didn't come out, so you want them to bust the door down?
Of course not. I'll think up a fib.
I can do better than that.
He climbed onto the hood of the Escalade and then onto the roof. He reached overhead, punched the smoke detector that was attached to the ceiling, and the fire alarm went off. He jumped down, and we ran out of the garage and hid in the wooded area. Lights went on all over the building, and after a minute the alarm went silent. 10 minutes later, the lights began blinking out, and there was no sign of police or a fire truck.
They must not be hooked into an alarm company, Morelli said.
My cell phone rang. It was Briggs, whispering so low I could barely hear him.
You gotta get me out of here, he said. I saw feet, big naked feet. I think they might have been dead, but I don't know for sure.
Were they attached to something, like a body?
They were sticking out from under a sheet.
Where are you?
I'm on the second floor, under a desk, and there's a guy sitting in that little lobby area reading a paper. I can't get past him.
Hang tight, I said. We're on it. I disconnected and looked at Morelli. He's under a desk on the second floor and can't get past some guy in the lobby.
Call him back and tell him to make more of an effort. I'm missing a really good ball game.
He said he saw naked feet sticking out from under a sheet. He sounded a little freaked.
Were they live naked feet or dead naked feet?
He said they might have been dead, but he couldn't be sure.
So much for the ball game,
Morelli said. We went to the door beside the drop box and found it locked.
They must have noticed the door was unlocked when they went around checking smoke detectors, Morelli said. This makes things more complicated.
We were standing there, hoping for a brilliant idea, when the garage door rolled up. We flattened ourselves against the building, the door went totally open, and Kruger's red Jaguar glided out of the garage and down the driveway. She's going to work, I said. The door started to roll down, and Morelli and I slipped under it and into the garage before it closed completely. A moment later, we saw the light go on over the elevator, indicating it was in motion.
Someone else is coming down, Morelli said.
We scrambled into a dark corner behind some packing crates and watched the elevator doors open and the Yeti come out carrying 2 insulated chests. He loaded the chests into the van, got behind the wheel, pressed the remote for the door, and drove out of the garage. Morelli grabbed my hand, yanked me across the garage at a full run, and we slid under the door just as it closed. He was instantly on his feet and sprinting across the lot through the small patch of woods. He had the Buick cranked over by the time my hand touched the door handle.
"Briggs can wait," he said, peeling out of the lot. "I want to see where the van is going."
We caught sight of the van just as it left the park and headed south on Route 1. It got off at Spruce, and 15 minutes later it turned into a private fixed-base operations facility at Mercer Airport. The van pulled up to the FBO gate, was admitted onto the tarmac, and drove up to a mid-sized business jet. The two insulated chests were handed over to the captain, and the Yeti drove the van off the field and back to the access road. Morelli called the plane's tail number into one of his contacts and asked for owner information. He listened to the answer, thanked the person at the other end, and put the Buick in gear.
"The plane is owned by France Sunshine Enterprises," Morelli said, "and it's filed a flight plan for a Nevada destination."
"I guess it's not a big surprise that Sunshine owns the plane since the chests came from his clinic."
"I wouldn't mind knowing what was in those chests," Morelli said.
"Drugs? Body parts? Lunch?" Morelli made another phone call and suggested that the chests be checked out on arrival in Nevada. "I suppose we should try to rescue Briggs," I said when Morelli finished his call.
"He's not my favorite person," Morelli said.
"He's not anyone's favorite person." We turned onto Route 1, and my phone rang. It was Briggs.
"Where the hell are you? I finally was able to get out by the skin of my teeth, and you're not here."
"We're 10 minutes away," I said. "We followed the white van to the airport, but we're on our way back."
"This clinic is Creep Central. I don't know what the heck they do here, but it involves dead people, and it smells bad."
"How many dead people did you see?"
"Just the one. Isn't that enough?"
"Is that what smells bad?"
"If the stiff smelled bad, I wouldn't know over the stench coming from the lounge. There's some guy cooking something in the microwave that's stinking up the whole floor. I heard someone call him Abu."
"Abu Damral," I said. Morelli looked over at me when I hung up.
"He saw dead people?"
"One, and he managed to get out. He's waiting for us in the lot." Chapter 26.
"I was getting lonely here," Briggs said when we parked and got out of the car.
We followed the Yeti to the airport and watched him hand over two insulated chests and leave. "I imagine he came back here." Briggs shook his head.
"He didn't come back here. Nobody's here. The doctor and the Abu guy just left. The only one who didn't leave is the dead guy, except I guess he could be in someone's trunk since he isn't in the hall anymore."
Morelli looked at the clinic.
"It's empty?"
"Yeah," Briggs said. "The party's over."
Morelli got a flashlight from the Buick.
"Let's take a tour."
There were no cars in the garage, just as Briggs had said. We entered the stairwell and climbed to the first floor in darkness. Morelli opened the door, and we moved into the first floor hall, also dark. We walked the length of it, returned to the stairwell, and went up another flight. The second floor hall had path lighting. Not so much that you could read by it, but enough that Morelli didn't need his flashlight. We did a quick check of the empty offices, crossed the lobby past the elevator bank and reception desk, and aimed light into the first patient room. It was just as I remembered it. Bed made, no sign of occupancy, ensuite bathroom unused. Morelli flashed light into the second patient room, and I saw that the bed was stripped bare. Somebody had been in the bed, and now they were gone, I thought. The guy with the feet. "This is different from when I was here," I said. "This bed was made up when I was here." We looked through the room in the bathroom, but found no left-behind personal effects. There was a lingering smell of antiseptic. The room had recently been cleaned. "Where did you see the feet?" I asked Briggs.
"In the hall here, outside this room."
Morelli looked over at me, probably checking to make sure I wasn't going to faint. We left the room and went across the hall to the lab. A half-filled coffee cup had been left on a counter, so the lab was clearly being used, but there were no obvious science experiments going on, no slides under the microscope, no petri dishes growing the unthinkable, no beakers of urine. Morelli went through drawers. He found nicotine gum, Rolaids, sticky pads, and pens, but no notes. No computer.
It used to be you could always look for a phone book,
Morelli said.
Now they're obsolete. Everyone carries their phone book in their phone. Same with computers. They're portable and almost never left behind.
We moved from the lab to the lounge. It was furnished in standard hospital lounge furniture. Inexpensive, easy to clean, beige and orange. Two round tables with four chairs each. Small kitchen area with a fridge, microwave, and sink. Large flat-screen television. Couch and two club chairs in front of the television. There were dishes in the sink. They'd been rinsed and left to dry. The surgery was the only room left to investigate. We all took a deep breath before pushing the door open, not sure what we expected to find, but we were all reluctant to enter. The room had no windows, so Morelli flipped the light switch, and we were blinded by brightness. I'd seen it before, and there were no surprises. No body on the table, no blood spatters, no gallon jugs for cellulite collection. Morelli looked around.
This is a really well-equipped room. You don't spend this kind of money if you aren't going to use the equipment. So what do they do here? My first thought would be very private cosmetic surgery, but the patient rooms weren't luxurious. What else could they use this for?
I had an idea, but I didn't want to say it out loud. It was too gruesome. I looked at Morelli, and I knew he had the same idea. Body parts. I heard the scuff of footsteps in the hall behind us, and turned to see the Yeti and France Sunshine.
Organ harvest, Sunshine said. Very lucrative. The donor never complains because he's dead, and the recipient is happy to pay an astronomical amount of money to live. It's a win-win deal. We only harvest from losers who have a reason to disappear, and we were doing well until Miss Plum came along. Now, as it turns out, we have three new donors.
I'm a dwarf, Briggs said. Nobody's going to want my organs. You might as well let me go. I won't tell anyone, I swear.
The Yeti was holding an assault rifle.
Don't anyone get frisky, he said. I have real good aim with this. I go for knees since they don't bring much money on the black market.
Why were you in Cubbin's house? I asked him.
Looking for his money. He said he had money hid there, but I couldn't find it.
He was trying to buy his way out of donating his heart?
Something like that, the Yeti said.
Let's move this along, Sunshine said. We're all going down to the garage now. Hands on your heads, single file. If anything bothersome happens, John will shoot you.
So the Yeti's name was John. We followed instructions and walked down the hall to the lobby. We shuffled into the elevator and lined up against the wall. The Yeti was steely-eyed with the assault rifle trained on us. Morelli was wearing his cop face, no emotion, watching the Yeti, waiting for his moment. I was still wearing Ranger's GPS watch. I had my hands on my head, one hand over my wrist, and I pushed the audio button. No one seemed to notice. I couldn't see the watch face, but I hoped I was sending. The elevator doors opened onto the garage, and we exited, hands still on our heads. The white van and a black Mercedes were parked side by side, noses to the wall.
You're going to turn and walk to the far side of the garage, Sunshine said. Walk very carefully. John is known to have a short fuse when he feels threatened.
I knew this to be true. He'd zapped me with a stun gun, and I hadn't seen it coming. We got to the end of the garage, and I realized there was a door that I hadn't noticed before. It had another of the number-sequenced locks on it, and it looked like a door to a vault. Sunshine punched in six numbers. The door released, he pulled it open, and cold air rushed out at us. I sensed Morelli shift foot to foot. He wasn't liking what he saw. What is this? I asked, hoping Ranger was listening.
It's a freezer, Sunshine said. Convenient for storing bodies until we can arrange disposal. Because we're short-staffed right now and can't sedate the three of you, we'll slow your respiration for a few hours. When Dr. Fish returns, you'll be barely alive, but hopefully some of your organs will be usable.
He flipped a switch, and a light went on in the freezer. It was commercial grade, possibly originally designed as a morgue, or maybe a walk-in for a shopping bag. Sunshine took the rifle from the Yeti and motioned for him to go into the freezer.
Hold them out, Sunshine said.
The Yeti went in and came out with a black plastic body bag. Whatever was in it was frozen solid and about 5'10". The Yeti lifted the bag and carried it to the van. He got a second frozen bag, struggled a little under the weight, and shoved it into the back of the van as well.
Pitchin' cubbin?
Morelli asked. Sunshine didn't answer. He handed the rifle over to the Yeti.
In you go, Sunshine said to Morelli.
Morelli lunged for the rifle, and the Yeti shot him in the leg. I screamed. The Yeti hit me in the stomach with the rifle butt, and I crumpled to the ground, unable to breathe.
I don't want to go in there, Briggs said. I'm too young. I'm not ready. I'm diseased. I've got everything. Herpes and warts. My liver's crap.
The Yeti herded Morelli and Briggs in and slammed the door shut. I was still lying on the cement floor.
Get up, Sunshine said. You're going with us in case we need a hostage.
Why would you need a hostage? I asked.
Your boyfriend is a cop. I don't know if he was stupidly acting alone or if this was a planned operation.
The Yeti dragged me up to my feet and prodded me with the rifle.
Move.
We reached the van, and Sunshine bound my hands at the wrist with electrician's tape. I couldn't stop from rolling my eyes. Geez Louise, I thought, how many times in one day can this happen? We all got into the van, Sunshine driving and the Yeti holding the gun on me. We motored out of the garage and down the driveway. I didn't see any rangeman cars. Where are we going? I asked.
The cemetery, of course, the Yeti said. It's not like we're animals. We give everyone a decent burial.
Sunshine went north on Route 1 for about a mile, and then turned into what I saw from a sign was a Sunshine Memorial Park. The cemetery gate opened, Sunshine drove through, and the gate closed behind us.
One of my many holdings, Sunshine said. This used to be farmland, but I got it for taxes. Turns out there's more money in death than in cows.
I'd had a chance to look at my watch before my wrists were taped, and I knew the audio was active. The plus sign was visible in the watch face. My hope was that Ranger had rescued Morelli and Briggs by now and gotten help from Morelli before he lost too much blood. I was trying to stay calm. This was helped by the fact that I was exhausted. The cemetery was dark, lit only by a sliver of moon. We drove through acres of headstones, all uniform. The Levitt town of cemeteries. Sunshine took a road that went off into a raw field. No headstones here. I was in the back of the van with the body bags, but I could see through the windshield. Sunshine pulled to the side and stopped. The Yeti hauled me out of the van and went back for the body bags. He dragged them to a big hole in the ground and pitched them in.
God bless, the Yeti said.
Now you, Sunshine said, get into the pit.
I thought I was a hostage.
Only for this far. The facility can't handle more than 2 patients at a time. The process becomes too complicated. We have to hold the donor and keep him healthy until all the recipients are in place. It's most lucrative when you can harvest multiple organs, but that requires precision timing.
The Yeti shoved me to the edge of the grave.
Get in, he said. Jump.
Are you going to bury me alive?
No, I'm going to shoot you, the Yeti said, but it's neater if you're already in the hole.
He shoved me again. I lost my balance and fell into the grave on top of the body bags. I saw the Yeti raise the rifle to shoot me. I opened my mouth to scream, but before I could make a sound, I heard crack, crack. The Yeti and Sunshine went down. I was on my back on the frozen corpses, numb not just from the cold seeping up into me, but from the horror of the day. I struggled to my feet and stood on one of the body bags to look over the edge of the hole. The Yeti and Sunshine were sprawled on the ground, not moving. I tried to climb out, but the dirt gave way under me. A car drove up in the dark. No headlights, but I could make out the outline. The car parked, and Ranger and 2 of his men got out. Ranger walked to the edge of the grave and jumped in. He lifted me up into the arms of one of his men, and I was back on solid ground. The man gave Ranger a hand up, and Ranger was next to me, cutting the tape off my wrists.
This is getting to be a bad habit, Ranger said. This is the second time I've had to cut you out of tape today.
Morelli? I asked him.
He's fine.
Getting locked in a freezer is a good way to stop bleeding from gunshot. Tank and Eugene got him out and took him to St. Francis.
I love this watch, I told him.
Remember to shut it off when you go into the bathroom. I don't want my men in the control room getting distracted.
A second car drove up, and Hal got out.
I'm going to have Hal take you home, Ranger said. I have some cleanup to do here.
Are you just going to shovel dirt on them?
I'd like to. That would be much easier. Unfortunately, the police will have to get involved.
Morelli, I found out, was still in surgery when we got to Trenton, so Hal dropped me off at St. Francis. I thanked him and told him it wasn't necessary for him to wait. He said the Buick was parked in the garage, and Morelli had the key. I waved Hal away and walked into the ER reception area. Briggs was there, huddled in a blanket, looking tired. He jumped to his feet the instant he saw me and rushed over, suddenly all smiles.
"We heard you were okay. What happened?" he asked.
"I got pushed into an open grave. It was awful." I felt myself choke up, and I swiped at tears. "Sorry," I said. "It's been a long day."
"Tell me about it. I was bawling like a baby in the meat locker. The tears were all frozen on my face when the range man guy broke in."
"How'd they get the door open?"
"The little guy, Eugene, had an electronic gizmo that figured out the combination. The whole operation was freaking impressive. Range man had an EMT truck and medics waiting for us when we got out."
"Thanks for staying with Morelli."
"No problem. I guess you'll take over now."
I nodded. "I'll wait here."
"That would be great. I think I pissed my pants when I got shoved into the freezer. I wouldn't mind going home and throwing these clothes away. I don't want anything that reminds me of tonight."
It was a couple more hours before I got to take Morelli home. We went to his house because Rex and Bob were there, and so I didn't have to worry about finding leftover pieces of Oren. Morelli was zonked out on painkillers, and I was so fatigued, I was vibrating. Chapter 27. Lula and Connie were already at the office when I rolled in Monday morning. Connie had a birthday cake on her desk. "Whose birthday?" I asked.
"No one's," Connie said. "We're celebrating that you're not dead."
"It was touch and go," I said. "Saturday isn't going down as one of my better days."
"Yeah, but you got a lot accomplished," Lula said. "You got a whole shitload of bad guys killed."
I scooped some icing off with my finger and ate it. "True, and I found Cubbin and Pitch." Connie and Lula exchanged glances. "What?" I asked.
"Turned out when they unzipped those bags, one of them was Pitch, but the other one was some homeless guy."
"That's impossible. What happened to Cubbin?" Lula and Connie did shoulder shrugs. They didn't know what happened to Cubbin. I called Morelli. "I just got into work, and I'm hearing it wasn't Cubbin in the body bag."
"I was briefed on it 2 minutes ago,"
Morelli said.
"It was Pitch and a John Doe."
"So where's Cubbin?"
"Dunno. Right now we can't confirm that he's dead."
"What did Nurse Kruger and Craig Fish have to say?"
"Kruger was found on the floor in her apartment, foaming at the mouth from an overdose. She's locked down at St. Francis. She's expected to live, but we haven't been able to question her yet. Craig Fish is in custody, but he isn't saying anything on advice of his lawyer."
"How's your leg?"
"It hurts like a bitch."
"I'll kiss it and make it better tonight."
"It's going to take more than a kiss, Cupcake."
Lula and Connie were watching me as I disconnected.
"So?"
Lula said. "Kruger and the doctor aren't talking. That means they can't confirm that Cubbin is dead. That means we don't get our bond back."
"I was counting on a bonus from that bond," Lula said. "I need new tires on the Firebird."
"Good thing Vinny isn't here," Connie said. "He'll be doubling up on his blood pressure medication. That was a huge bond."
I sliced off a piece of the birthday cake and sat down to eat it. "Let's think about this. We're pretty sure they had Cubbin. We saw the Yeti push something out in the laundry hamper, and the Yeti said he was looking for Cubbin's money, so obviously Cubbin talked to him. If Cubbin escaped, he would have gone to the police. At the very least, he would have tried to access some of his money. If he didn't escape, he's dead. He wasn't in the freezer, and he wasn't in the rest of the clinic. So he must be..." Lula and Connie stared at me. "In the cemetery," I said. "That's where they disposed of the bodies."
"Uh-oh," Lula said. "I'm not liking this turn of events. I like cemeteries even less than I like hospitals."
I finished my cake and thought about taking a second piece. Not a good idea, I told myself. I'd go into a sugar and lard-induced coma. I'm going to the cemetery to take a look around, I said. Anyone want to come with me?
I guess I need to make sure you don't get into more trouble, Lula said. The one day I'm not with you, all hell breaks loose, what with crazy people getting exploded in your foyer.
A half hour later, I turned off Route 1 into Sunshine Memorial Park. It looked a lot less sinister during the day, but it would never win any awards for beauty. The first couple acres were flat. No trees, no shrubs, no flowers, just small headstones sunk into the ground. I followed the road to the part of the park that was undeveloped. There were some hills there and an occasional tree. The grass was scrubby. I drove past the large excavated pit that Sunshine and the Yeti had tried to bury me in. The grass around it was trampled from police and emergency vehicles. The pit was still open. Yellow crime scene tape fluttered on stakes in the ground. I parked, and Lula and I got out and walked to the hole in the ground.
This had to be scary as snot, Lula said. It's creeping me out, and it's not even nighttime.
It was okay until I got pushed into the hole. I left the gravesite and returned to the road. Cubbin hasn't been missing all that long. If they buried him here, the ground would still be freshly disturbed. You look on one side and I'll look on the other. After a couple minutes, Lula called out that she'd found some freshly dug dirt. Me too, I said. I have two potential gravesites here.
How are we going to know which one of these is Cubbin? Lula asked.
I guess we have to dig them all up.
Nuh-uh. Lula doesn't dig up dead people. You get cooties like that, and they don't like being disturbed. They get pissy and put the whammy on you. You don't want to do it either. You get in enough trouble all on your own. You can't afford to have the whammy.
If I go to the police, it'll take forever. They'll have to get special permission and court orders and grave diggers, and I need the money. I just ran my credit card over my limit, sending Tiki back to Hawaii.
What we need is our own grave digger,
Lula said. And I know just such a person.
You're thinking about Simon Diggory, Lula said. I'd rather dig the grave myself than have dealings with Diggory. Last time we went to his crap-ass trailer, you opened a closet door and a 20-foot snake fell out.
Simon Diggory was a wiry little guy in his 50s. His brown hair was shot with gray and usually tied back in a ponytail. His skin was like old cracked leather, and he had arms like Popeye's. He lived in a raggedy double-wide in Bordentown with his wife, his six kids, his brother Melvin, Melvin's pet python, and their uncle Bill. They were like a bunch of feral cats living in the woods, and Simon Diggory was Trenton's premier grave robber. I have a shovel in the trunk, I said. We could start digging.
Okay, Lula said. I was bluffing. Let's go talk to Diggory.
I was bluffing, too. I didn't have a shovel in the trunk. It took almost 40 minutes to find Diggory's trailer. It was off Route 206 down a winding two-lane road filled with potholes. The rusted-out, cankerous trailer was up on cinder blocks and held together with duct tape. I knocked on the door, and Lula stayed about 10 feet behind me with her gun drawn. Put the gun away, I said. You'll scare him.
What if the snake attacks us? That snake could eat you in one gulp. I saw it with my own eyes. It's a King Kong of snakes.
Diggory opened the door and squinted out at me.
I didn't do it, he said.
What didn't you do? I asked him.
Whatever it is you're going to arrest me for.
I'm not going to arrest you. I want to hire you.
You mean a job?
Yes.
I don't need a job. I get food stamps.
What about the snake? Can you get snake food with food stamps?
We just let him loose under the trailer to catch rats. We got enough rats to feed a whole pack of pythons. I'm out of here, Lula said. I heard that, and I'm not staying around with no snakes and rats. I got peep-toed shoes on, and my big toe could look like a snack.
It could be fun, I said to Diggory. I know where there are some unrecorded graves.
Unrecorded graves? It's hard to find them these days. Mostly you have to go to the landfill in Camden. I might be interested in some unrecorded graves.
Terrific. Grab a shovel and let's go.
Hey, Melvin,
Simon Diggory yelled into the dark trailer.
We got some unrecorded graves to dig. Put your pants on and let's go.
Simon and Melvin followed us in a pickup that was in worse shape than their trailer. It was eaten up with cancerous rot, spewing black smoke. Its tailgate held on with clothesline.
It's never going to make Route 1, Lula said. I think I just saw the muffler fall off.
I was praying that the truck would hold together long enough to get to the cemetery because I really didn't want to put Melvin and Simon in the Buick. We turned into Sunshine Memorial Park, and the truck was down to 15 miles per hour, lurching and belching fire from the undercarriage. We made it to the unmarked graves, the truck gasped to a shuddering stop, and Simon and Melvin jumped out and got shovels, all excited, ready to go. "Geez," I said, "sorry about your truck."
"What about it?" Simon said.
"It sounded like there might be a mechanical problem."
"It's just temperamental," Simon said. "It gets ornery when we go a distance. Where's these graves you were talking about?"
"There are three of them in this area, two on this side of the road and one on the other." I showed him my file picture of Jeffrey Cubbin. "I'm looking for this guy. If you find him, he's mine, but I'll give you his jewelry if he has any. The others are all yours."
"Sounds fair," Simon said. "Let's get to work."
"We're going to hell for this," Lula said.
"This here's sacrilegious or something. I'm pretty sure it's a sin."
30 minutes into the dig, Simon yelled out that he'd found something.
"I think this might be your man," he said. "Come take a look."
"I'm not looking," Lula said. "I get nightmares about these things. I get chased by boogeymen all the time. Sometimes they look like people I know."
I walked over and forced myself to look beyond the pile of dirt Simon had accumulated. I caught a glimpse of a black body bag partially unzipped, and what was in the bag wasn't in perfect shape.
"He's still pretty good," Simon said. "I've seen a lot worse. Sure, he's a little wormy and all, but you could see he's got the right color hair. Some of that's left, and I took a ring off him that had his initials on."
"Good enough for me," I said. "Zip him up and get him in my car." Simon and Melvin lugged the body bag to the Buick and shoved it into the trunk.
"He don't all fit," Simon said. "He's not at that stage yet where he bends easy. Problem is, as you can see, he's a little gassed up."
"Maybe I could borrow your clothesline to hold the lid down," I said to Simon. Simon took the clothesline off his tailgate. The tailgate fell onto the road, and he picked it up and tossed it into the back of his truck. Simon and Melvin tied the lid of my trunk to the bumper so Jeffrey Cubbin wouldn't slide out onto the highway, and we were good to go. I gave Simon and Melvin each a 20, and they thanked me profusely and went back to digging.
"I have to say I admire your determination to get the job done," Lula said when we were back on Route 1. "I'm freaked out about it all, but I gotta hand it to you. You got guts."
"Hey," I said, "no guts, no glory."
"That's so true," Lula said. "I say that all the time. That's practically my motto."
I turned off Route 1 onto Olden and slowed down. "Keep your eye on Jeffrey in case he bounces out when we go over the railway tracks," I said to Lula.
"He seems like he's okay," Lula said. "I think a lady just run her car up on a curb looking at him, but he's holding tight."
I swung into the police lot and parked near the back entrance. Lula and I ran around to the back of the Buick, untied the clothesline, and lugged Cubbin into the docket lieutenant. "Jeffrey Cubbin," I said, setting him on the floor. I pulled my documentation out of my messenger bag and presented it. "I need a body receipt." There were a bunch of cops keeping their distance, gawking at us.
"Lady, that smells really bad," one of them said.
"He's a little gassy," I told him.
"Yeah, we can all relate to that," Lula said.
"How am I supposed to know it's Cubbin?"
the lieutenant at the desk asked. "Some of his hair is left," I said, "and he's got most of his teeth. You can identify him by his teeth." Clumps of dirt were still clinging to the body bag, falling off onto the floor. The lieutenant grimaced.
"What did you do, dig him up?"
"Of course not," I said. "That would be illegal, right?"
"Right," the lieutenant said.
"We found him on the side of the road," Lula said. "We was driving along and we saw this body bag and stopped to investigate, and lo and behold, we realized it was Jeffrey Cubbin. He must have fallen off a truck or something."
The lieutenant looked down at Cubbin.
"I can't give you a receipt until we identify him."
"That could take weeks," I said. "Maybe months."
"I can't wait months," Lula said. "Somebody's going to have to step up to the plate and make an executive decision here. And in fact, this is making me all upset, and I'm going to be sick. I have a delicate constitution, and I feel my lunch coming up. It was cabbage leaves stuffed with rice and pork. It's not going to be good. Cabbage throw-up is the worst. Oh, Lord, I'm sweating now. It's coming up any time."
"Get her out of here," the lieutenant said.
"No way," Lula said. "Even though I'm sick, I can't leave until she gets a body receipt. Maybe if I stick my finger down my throat, it would come up faster and I'd feel better."
"That's disgusting," he said.
"It's just nature taking its course," Lula said. "I might even be getting diarrhea, too."
He grimaced and scribbled out a receipt.
"Take it. Go. Take her with you."
Lula and I hustled out of the station, jumped into the Buick, and took off.
That went well, Lula said. I'm hungry. All that talk about cabbage and pork got me thinking about one of them Taylor pork roll sandwiches.
I had one loose end to tie up. I had Susan Cubbin drinking coffee in a kitchen filled with gold bars, not knowing what to do with them. I parked and followed Lula into the office. I gave Connie my body receipt and took a chair by her desk. What do you know about gold? I asked her.
Not a whole lot. What do you want to know?
How much a bar is worth? Connie surfed around on her computer.
Gold is up today. A kilo bar would be around $50,000.
I was pretty sure Susan had kilo bars. I punched some numbers into the calculator on my phone and gasped at the result. Over the course of Jeffrey's career at Cranberry Manor, he'd embezzled $5 million, converted it to gold, and the gold was now worth $6,650,000. Turned out Jeffrey Cubbin was the best thing that ever happened to the folks at Cranberry Manor. Gotta go, I said to Connie and Lula.
Are you buying gold?
Connie asked. No, I'm helping Susan Cubbin clean house. I'll tell you all the details tomorrow. 40 minutes later, I was in Susan's kitchen. It's worth more than he stole, I told her. Gold has risen in value since Jeffrey bought it. All you have to do is take the gold to Cranberry Manor and tell the residents it was a misunderstanding, that Jeffrey was actually making smart investments on their behalf. They'll probably name a wing after him. I wasn't 100% sure it would go down like that, but it was the best I could do. Susan had sheets draped over the stacks of gold.
How am I going to get this moved? Do I need to hire an armored truck?
I have a friend, I said. I called Ranger and told him I needed to transport 133 kilos of gold.
Now?
Now would be good.
I'll send Tank with a couple cars. I have a client meeting in 5 minutes. I assume I'm not necessary.
You're desirable, but in this case, not necessary, I told him.
Babe,
Ranger said, and he disconnected. 2 Rangeman SUVs arrived. We loaded the SUVs and headed out. I led the parade in the Buick, and Susan brought up the tail in her van. We parked in front of Cranberry Manor, and I told Tank to stack the gold up in the lobby.
This is from Jeffrey, Susan Cubbin said to the room filled with gawkers. It was all a misunderstanding. I found a note from him, and it turns out he was investing your money in gold, and now you're all rich.
There was a stunned silence, and then a cheer went up.
It worked, Susan said to me. Let's get out of here before they start asking questions.
We'll need a receipt, I said to Carol, the facility's tour guide. She counted the bars and wrote out a receipt.
132 bars, she said.
I looked at Susan.
I might have left one in the kitchen, Susan said.
132 bars is correct, I said to Carol. I stopped at Pino's, got lasagna with meat sauce, extra bread, and tiramisu for dessert, and took it to Morelli's house. He was on the couch watching television with his leg propped up on the coffee table. Bob was by his side, offering sympathy, standing guard. How's it going? I asked.
It's going good, and it's even better now that I have you here with dinner.
I went to the kitchen and got knives and forks and napkins and beer and brought it all back to Morelli.
I hear Cranberry Manor had some good fortune today, Morelli said. Apparently a photographer and a news guy arrived shortly after you left.
Jeffrey had the bars buried in his backyard. Susan found a landscape plan and dug them up. When I got there, she had them stacked up in her kitchen.
Why did she give them back?
I shrugged. I guess she felt bad. I think she might not have had a storybook marriage, but she cared for him. Probably she still loved him. She didn't want to be the one to rat on him.
Suppose it was me, Morelli said, and I had gold buried in my backyard.
I'd love you even more. Morelli grinned.
So are you telling me that you love me? Just not as much as if I were rich.
Yep, that's what I'm telling you.
Good to know,
Morelli said. We ate dinner and watched television, and Morelli was asleep on the couch by 9 o'clock. I got him upstairs, gave him a pill, and tucked him in. I carted Rex out to the Buick and drove to my apartment. Stars were out, and the air felt warm and gentle. My apartment building looked benign and safe, dark against the night sky, lights shining from my neighbor's windows. I took the elevator, walked the length of the hall, and balanced the hamster tank on one knee while I opened my front door. I stepped inside and flipped on the light. Everything looked perfect. No Oren splattered on the wall. No broken window. Clean floor. There was a bottle of champagne on my kitchen counter, plus a check, and a note from Ranger. "For a job well done," the note said. "I'll be around later. I need a date." This is Lorelei King. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Notorious 19 by Janet Ivanovich. This program was produced by Dan Musselman. Text copyright 2012 by Ivanovich Inc. Production copyright 2012, Random House Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.